Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hi all, it's Friday night, and Alex and I, who are about to run out the door, waited until the last minute to put this baby together because that's how we roll. Actually, in fairness, Alex is super punctual, which is very Scottish of him. I am, on the other hand, the child of Greeks. And if you've ever been to Greece, you may understand where I'm going with this. Let's just say the time is more of a general feeling there than something measured in hours and minutes. Put another way, I have to keep this short or Alex will strangle me. So we are going to jump right into a news story, then our featured interview of the week with a founder who I think you'll enjoy meeting. He's putting together a whole lot of pieces to build a fintech empire and in an order that we haven't seen previously. Stick around for it. But first, that news story.
Instacart wants to go public, and it released an offering prospectus today in the hopes of attracting new investors for its IPO. However, the numbers raised questions about whether it will be able to jumpstart the tech IPO market as some might have hoped. Although the company showed a $428 million profit for 2022, $358 million of this amount was described as a tax benefit. Sales for the first half of this year were also flat compared to the same period last year, and online advertising, that is, selling space in its checkout carts to advertisers interested in reaching Instacart shoppers, made up almost 30% of its revenue. If one subtracts out the tax benefit, we are left with a 9-year-old company with $70 million in net income and almost $3 billion in paid-in capital that has stagnant revenue in its core business and an internal valuation that has decreased from $39 billion to $10 billion in the last 18 months. Although Instacart revealed today that PepsiCo has committed to invest $175 million in new shares in a private placement as part of Instacart's IPO, it's hard to see how the online grocer's public offering will jumpstart the market for new issues. That's not good for tech investors. As Breon Lynch, head of market insights at Equity Zen, told the New York Times today, at least 1,400 private tech companies worth $1 billion or more are waiting to go out. Investors might take more comfort in the financials of Arm, the chip design company funded by SoftBank that filed to go public this past Monday. Although Arm's top-line revenue is similar to Instacart's, and its revenue actually fell from fiscal year 2021 to fiscal year 2022, it has 95% plus gross margins, a solid $524 million in net income, and a central place in the AI universe, which, as we know, seems to be growing at warp speed. Still, the market may need many more arms before the IPO market will be able to absorb all of the tech companies waiting in the wings. When the tech IPO market is flagging, what is a venture capitalist supposed to do? Invest in real estate, as it turns out. In a fascinating piece in today's Times, reporters Connor Dougherty and Aaron Griffith write about a massive land deal 60 miles northeast of San Francisco that counts as investors a virtual who's who of the tech world. Spearheaded by Jan Ramek, a former Goldman Sachs trader, the deal involves converting thousands of acres of Solano County farmland worth some $800 million into a busy city that its backers claim could generate thousands of jobs and be as walkable as Paris or the West Village in New York. One of the project's chief proponents and backers is Mike Moritz, the legendary Sequoia Capital venture capitalist who summarized the vision to a potential investor in a note back in 2017. "Let me know if this tickles your fancy," he wrote. Other investors include LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, Mark Andreessen and Chris Dixon, VCs at Andreessen Horowitz, who have apparently invested personally alongside their firm, Patrick and John Collison, the sibling co-founders of Stripe, and Laureen Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow and the founder of the venture firm Emerson Collective. Ramek's company, called Flannery Associates, has apparently been gobbling up properties for years and letting nothing slip. In fact, California Congressman John Garamendi, who represents constituents in a neighboring district, admitted to the Times that he had been trying to find out for years who was gobbling up so much property. Now, Ramek and company have apparently decided that they have to go public in order to win the approvals they will need to rezone the land for the kind of urban development they have in mind. It's a tall order, particularly given the clogged two-lane highway that connects Solano County to the rest of the world, let alone the water and infrastructure such a city would require. But as the history of Los Angeles reminds us, California is no stranger to surreptitious land deals. In the immortal words of screenwriter Robert Towne, "Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown." Up next, Connie's interview with Michael Brown, co-founder and CEO of TeamShares. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the modern research platform for leading investors. Tired of running your own expert calls to get up to speed on a company? Tegas lets you ramp faster and find answers to critical questions more efficiently than any alternative method. The gold standard for research, the Tegas platform delivers unmatched access to timely qualitative insights through the largest and most differentiated expert call transcript database. With over 60,000 transcripts spanning 22,000 public and private companies, investors can accelerate their fundamental research process by discovering highly differentiated and reliable insights that can't be found anywhere else in the market. As a Strictly VC listener, you can test drive Tegas for free at tegas.com/SVC. That's tegus.com/SVC.
TeamShares is a low-flying, New York-based startup with big ambitions to capitalize on an opportunity in plain sight, that of small businesses without a succession plan. It isn't a small market. According to the U.S. Small Business Administration, small businesses represent 99.7% of U.S. employer firms and 64% of private sector jobs. Meanwhile, just 15% or so of small business owners pass along their company to a family member, with many others simply closing up shop at some point. With an aging population in the U.S., TeamShares is betting this market will grow even bigger. Following is a conversation with the company's co-founder and CEO, Michael Brown, who worked in investment banking before putting together enough money with a former colleague to buy a small company, and then another, and another. Ultimately, he struck on the idea of a network of small businesses loosely threaded together, and thus, TeamShares was born. We'd actually seen a funding blurb for this company late last week, and while 90% of these blurbs look very much the same after a while, this one really stood out, and we're glad we chased down Brown to talk about it further. Here's that conversation.
I have not heard of a company doing exactly what TeamShares is doing, other than maybe like KKR, and I don't know if that's a good comparison, but I know that it buys companies and that increasingly it's focused on employee ownership, thinking that owners tend to be better employees, they stick around, et cetera, et cetera. But back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about your background and how you decided to start TeamShares in the first place.
Sure, absolutely. So I spent the first 7 years of my career in investment banking, and that's where I met Alex and Kevin, our two other founders. Kevin decided he wanted to join the tech industry very early. He left after his first year, and he was the fourth employee at a coding bootcamp called General Assembly. First product manager, learned how to code. So he went off on a technical career. Alex and I went and bought one and then eventually eight small businesses. And a couple of things happened as we did that. So we obviously transitioned from being financial spreadsheet people to being operators and later entrepreneurs. We were able to take nearly all the cost out of acquiring a business. The learning to operate a business is what informs our president program today. And we recruit really talented people out of places like McKinsey and Tesla and out of HBS to come run small businesses. Where employee ownership came from was that our largest customer at the first company that we acquired was this $8 billion revenue, fully employee-owned business called PCL. It's the largest general contractor in Canada. And it was bought from the founding family a generation previously for something like $40 million. So in the span of about a generation, it went from a very successful, small, family-owned middle market business to being one of the largest and most prominent companies in Canada and created many, many millionaires along the way. And so it became obvious to us that employee ownership was both good for people and good for business. So we started studying it. We became pretty intellectually fascinated with it. We experimented very casually with it, started sharing the financials internally with the electricians. But we, you know, at the time, we weren't trying to build a venture-backed business. We were literally just buying businesses and learning how to run them. How TeamShares came to be was that by 2018, Alex and Kevin and I started working together, just three people in a room, working on this problem of why is it so hard to sell a small business? There's like a 70% failure rate when someone goes to sell a small business. And we realized after about a year of working together in a room that the problem was that small businesses were never really supposed to be for sale. They used to just get transitioned from generation to generation within a family. And as people started sending their kids to college, kids stopped coming back to the business. So basically, after this 7 or 8 year journey together as friends and then business partners, we had the idea for TeamShares, which was to help small businesses become employee owned and build a financial technology platform to serve them. And at that moment, we decided to go raise venture.
So when you were buying businesses previously, were you borrowing from the bank? How were you financing those acquisitions?
Yeah, in the beginning, it was us using our own savings. We went to some colleagues and some family members, and I think we got a bank loan, I think, for our first acquisition as well. But it was pretty scrappy. We were using our own capital and extended friends and family. And sometimes in a small business acquisition, too, you have what's called a seller note, which means that you have a debt to the seller that you have to pay over time as well.
And how did you exit those businesses?
We still own the ones in Canada. They are running themselves today. There's a president and a vice president. They're not actually a part of TeamShares. They're just like a dormant legacy business, but they've started the employee ownership journey too. And that's continuing on.
That's great. And so you make money off of those businesses through dividends essentially, or?
Yeah. So how TeamShares makes money is we buy businesses. We dilute ourselves voluntarily to get employee ownership jump started. So we do 10% for all the employees and additional 5% for the president. And that stock is a gift. It's earned over time through service. And there are two main revenue streams for TeamShares. From a financial standpoint, we're a consolidation accounting, just like Berkshire Hathaway. So if we buy a business with $5 million of revenue, that then becomes our revenue the next day. But in terms of how we profit from that, we profit from all of the profits of the business that was acquired, proportionate to our ownership. And we sell our stock back over time to the companies until it becomes 80% employee owned. And then we have new revenue streams that we've just started launching. We've built a neobank and are going to be changing out all the banks. We're soon to launch credit cards, and we're building an insurance business as well. So there's a secondary layer of financial products, basically replacing the vendors that the companies used to use.
Super interesting. So these products are going to be available exclusively to TeamShares companies, or you're going to start there and expand out?
The hope is the latter. We only build something if a product doesn't exist for our exact use case. And our use case is some combination of just really traditional small businesses or employee ownership. You know, when we set out, we didn't think we would build a neobank. But as we studied the landscape, there just wasn't something that existed to our satisfaction, in part because small businesses still unfortunately use checks. They receive a lot of checks. So right now it's being built exclusively for the businesses that TeamShares has acquired to make employee owned. But the hope would be that in the future, there's no timeline for this, but let's call it in the next 5 years, we would hope at scale to open these products up and have small businesses generally get to know TeamShares and employee ownership through these products.
So today's neobanks are a little bit too forward-thinking. They're too digital for your customers.
That's right. I mean, they're built for internet companies or very small digital-first companies. Like if you started an architecture firm 3 years ago, you're probably not writing checks. Right. And so there's lots of legacy things and there's tons of great products out there. But yeah, we wouldn't build a product for the sake of building it. Like we wouldn't build a CRM software, right? Because there's publicly traded companies that have incredible CRM tools that we wouldn't need to replicate.
So what was interesting to me about TeamShares is that, again, you raised equity and you did not raise debt.
We didn't include debt in the announcement because we've seen overstated announcements that combine them. But like any home acquisition or business acquisition, a majority of the acquisition is done with debt.
Okay. Can you tell me how much debt you've secured?
It's around $150 million.
Okay. And so how many companies have you acquired to date and how many are you on pace to acquire over the next, say, 12 months?
So today we have 84 companies. Wow. And by next year, we would be well north of 100.
And they all share basically some of the same back-end processes that you've built.
So where we have commonality in the companies is around employee ownership, financial education, the PRESIDENT program, and financial infrastructure. We're audited by KPMG, for example. And so we have to help these companies go from what's called mom and pop accounting to have real financial infrastructure and be able to produce three statement financials every month that are in accordance with GAAP. Operationally, we actually really believe in the companies trying to be as independent as possible. We provide support and we work closely with the presidents, but we don't think that it's a good idea to try and integrate all the companies in most cases. There are some exceptions where, for example, we've been buying pizza shops in a state back east, and those are being integrated to create one larger company that's going to create more employee ownership wealth as a single company than a standalone set of pizza shops. But in general, we think these are really high quality businesses that can operate fairly independently.
But is there a roll-up strategy here? So the pizza companies, it sounds like these were individual companies that you combined into one.
Yeah. So when I say roll-up, traditionally, obviously, a roll-up is built to sell very quickly. That's not what we're doing, right? The fate of all these companies is to become employee-owned. But we do see certain opportunities in industries, like we're doing this again in pool maintenance, where a lot of the businesses are really, really subscale. And actually getting a first one that's small, but big enough to support the cost of a president. And then you can add smaller ones. So there's a roll-up-esque element to certain companies we work with. But in general, TeamShares itself is not a roll-up and we're not building to sell. The fate of all companies is to become 80% employee-owned.
And so there's nothing on your roadmap that includes helping these companies become maybe PE targets down the road.
No, we actually make a very devout customer promise that the companies are going to become 80% employee owned and are never for sale again.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you've got pool maintenance, pizza shops. What are you looking for exactly?
So I'll tell you what types of companies are a part of TeamShares and then tell you a little bit about how we get there. There are over 40 specific industries, but they really fall into about six categories, which are business services, consumer services, distribution, manufacturing, restaurants, and retail. So they're all backbone traditional economy businesses that are on average 30 years old. Revenues 2 to 10 million generally. We have a belief that employee ownership works in every industry. Our actual final decision amongst the 70,000 leads we get every year is all done on a case-by-case basis, but we start off by filtering the companies on what we call our structural criteria. So is it a true retirement sale? Are the owners of that age, right? Are there two or more managers, right? Is there low customer concentration? Do the earnings show up in the tax returns, which is not a given? But after we get through those structural criteria, we're really looking case by case on if it's a business that is going to transcend the owner's retirement and transition.
How much have you raised altogether? So this was a $245 million round. Is this your second or third round of funding?
This is our Series D. We just never announced a round before. So what is that? Probably technically round six.
Oh, wow. So how much have you raised altogether?
The 245 was cumulative and the Series D was 124. So our early rounds were pretty small, especially considering the times in which they occurred. So like our Series A was with Inspired Capital and Union Square Ventures, and that was 7 million. And that was considered a very, very tiny Series A at the time.
And why not go public sooner with your funding?
A couple of reasons. So we observed during that era that there were a lot of founders who went with publicity first and didn't actually really build a great company. And I think it can be a real distraction. And so we always wanted to have a very public brand, right? A company that's a national brand and a trusted brand, a beloved brand. But we thought all of this is going to come from building a great company, executing and winning over customer trust and loyalty. And that doesn't happen day one. So rather than go out and start announcing things, that to us felt like putting the cart before the horse. We just focused on building a company. Now we're at a certain scale where we thought it made a lot more sense.
Are there other ways that your companies work together? I mean, you're creating this whole ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though from a legal standpoint, they are subsidiaries of TeamShares that are over time spinning off to become 80% employee owned and deconsolidate. We consider and call the companies a network. And we do it in a couple of ways. All the presidents themselves come in training cohorts and then have access to the broad president network. We started that journey again, actually, with the general managers who are generally promotes from within. And that peer-based learning is a model that we learned in Entrepreneurs Organization and YPO, and we really believe in. And we're now getting to the size, we're starting to organize the companies specifically around industry groups. So there's talk of the restaurant companies all banding together and having common purchasing. And the presidents obviously share knowledge about what's the best ERP system and other software to use. And then there's other things too that don't make sense for us to build, but we can arrange large corporate vendor partnerships. So for example, lots of these companies need vehicles, right? And so having a national account, one of the major vehicle lessors, is going to make sense.
You mentioned Berkshire Hathaway early on. Is that the model that you aspire to build? And is this company going to go public someday? When your VCs were backing you, they write a check and they have an exit strategy in mind.
Yeah, of course. So maybe I'll take it in reverse order. So I think all the VCs and the founders and all the people that are working for it, I think everyone is trying to build a large and enduring company, right? And I think that was the reason we were able to raise venture. And from the beginning, our plan was to build a large independent company that would be around in a couple of centuries. The most probable outcome is we go public, but there are ways to stay private too. We do not plan to ever sell team shares. We would want it to be independent. So it would either be public or it would stay private. But either way, we just trying to plan on building a really large company, because the larger we are, the larger impact we can make on wealth inequality through employee ownership. In terms of the Berkshire Hathaway piece, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of inspiration. There are probably five or so companies we take a lot of inspiration from, and Berkshire Hathaway is one of them. We subscribe to a lot of their philosophy about being very long-term minded and being pretty efficient in our underwriting and keeping things simple. But we're not a one-for-one translation of the model, because their model is to have the permanent ownership forever, whereas our model has employee ownership. A twist, right? So we're actually foregoing some amount of future growth by making employee ownership happen. And we believe that's the right thing to do. And we believe the companies will be bigger and better for it. And the other actually notable thing about Berkshire Hathaway is they can only buy companies that already have a CEO in place, whereas that's not a luxury you can have in small business. So we realized we had to build up a new generation of people, generally in their 30s and 40s, who are ready for something more entrepreneurial and ready for something really mission aligned. And so we recruit and train people out of some really great companies from McKinsey and USAA and Tesla and Amazon that are coming to run these small businesses. So we're inspired by Berkshire Hathaway, amongst other companies like Stripe and Patagonia and lots of great companies that have come before us. But it's not like a one-for-one translation.
Yeah. And it's not a one-for-one translation, obviously, with a PE shop either. I like KKR at the outset.
I think what KKR is doing around employee ownership is very admirable. I think private equity has come a long way from what it was in the 1980s. And the way KKR describes employee ownership is the same philosophy we have. It's table stakes, right? Mm-hmm. When we think about Silicon Valley, our own thesis on Silicon Valley, why it happened here, why the US, obviously everyone knows the universities, but widespread employee stock options, in our opinion, are the number two reason why Silicon Valley happened in the States. And it is all because of basically one person, Arthur Rock, who drove around the Valley convincing investors first to give stock to management and then eventually to all employees. And so we view team shares as a company, almost like we are Arthur Rock as a company. Mm-hmm. And we are trying to rewire a small business to make it table stakes to have employee stock ownership. And before team shares, employee stock ownership just basically doesn't exist in small business because it's pretty hard to do.
I was going to ask, I mean, is there a comp? Who are your most direct rivals? Of course, everything you're going after is so fragmented. I mean, the opportunity is probably endless, but is anyone doing what you're doing?
There's no one we're aware of that's doing exactly what we're doing. I mean, obviously, there are instances of small businesses coming to employee ownership on their own, but it's a long journey to figure out the legal mechanics, and there's thousands of decisions to make. The other thing, too, is that it's very vulnerable to convert to employee ownership, because in doing that, you're opening up the books. And if you're a privately owned family business and you've been making X dollars per year, all of a sudden, everyone gets to see the financials. And that's a very intimate experience and a very scary one for a lot of small businesses. So it's pretty uncommon to see small businesses. But yes, there are consulting firms out there that would be helping small businesses become employee owned on a small scale. And we're rooting for all of it. We think it's all great.
It's interesting that you're doing what you're doing now, because this year it's been all about AI. And we're seeing that generative AI is really going to disrupt businesses, and it's kind of a reverse order than was expected originally, which is law firms and journalists and a lot of this white collar work that could be replicated more easily. So it seems like it's good timing in a lot of ways. But I also wonder, in addition to the fact that, as you mentioned, people aren't returning to run their parents' businesses like they might have 20, 30 years ago. But I am curious how you are using AI yourselves, or if there's an AI strategy to fuel what you're building.
We're very much at the beginning of that journey. I think the first place that I think it's helping across the tech sector is it's helping engineers code faster, more accurately. So that's the first use case. We're actually just starting to get together now to think about how to apply it to the businesses. I know part of our team that works on growth marketing has been experimenting with it and had some early successes. But I would say we are very, very early in the journey. We're a very tech-oriented firm. We have 50 people working on software and a broader 70-person tech team compared to two investment analysts. But even then, so much you have to think about small businesses. Yeah. I mean, some of them don't even have great websites, or they're still on QuickBooks, right? Which is a great product, but it's just not a modern piece of software. So I think a lot of the traditional small businesses we're working with, there are a few steps before AI can even become usable.
Right. And you said you have a 70-person tech team?
Yeah, we've closed 7 companies a month with 2 people. I think if you were to compare that to the methods used in private equity, a typical investment analyst or associate might close 0 to 2 transactions per year. So we've created a lot of leverage through building a lot of software for ourselves and for the companies, and we'll continue to do so.
How many employees altogether?
About 140.
And in terms of verticals that you might be chasing after right now, is that how you go about pursuing companies? You come up with themes and you look for the best opportunities?
Yeah, it's not as top down as you would think because of the volume. I mean, our mission and our financial incentive is to be as big as possible, right? So that means to have as big an addressable market as possible. And so we think about just structural criteria of what makes a business that would work for us in terms of financial quality. And we have found that these 6 sectors I mentioned earlier are where most of the action is. But we are constantly, especially as we've grown to a statistically significant number, we want to keep adding new industries and keep learning. Because look, when we started, I mean, I remember in seed and series A pitches being like, we'll never buy a restaurant. Restaurants are really tough businesses. Actually, some of our best performing companies are restaurants. And somewhere along the way, an engineer said, what if we just bought a restaurant? And we're like, what? We're big enough now. Let's try it. And so I think that we will want to continue to expand into as many industries as possible.
That's great. Well, as the child of restaurateurs, I could really see how important the employee ownership model would be here, because obviously that's an industry that's really rife with turnover. And if they've got a vested interest in sticking around and making the business continue working, that's really smart. Anyway, Michael, really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for walking me through what you're building. I'm eager to keep tabs on you.
Yeah, great to meet you. And thanks for the great questions. And we'll talk soon.
That's it. Thanks very much for listening, and special thanks to Tegas. Please check them out at tegas.com/SVC. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.